clerk will call the docket.
Commonwealth of Virginia against Gregory Edward Leonard II, Mark R. Herring, Attorney General, Lawrence C. Campbell, Assistant Attorney General, Steve Helen, Michael Weston, Steve Kelly.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, Lauren Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth in this appeal. May I request 3 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor?
Yes, that's not something you generally ask for, is it?
No, Your Honor. New and different. The Commonwealth is asking this court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals in Virginia and to affirm the judgment of the trial court, since the Court of Appeals erroneously concluded that even though the defendant had two prior valid convictions for DUI, the 2010 valid conviction order could not be admitted into evidence for purposes of sentencing enhancement. First, as the Court of Appeals did recognize, there is no evidence that that 2010 conviction order is invalid. In fact, the validity of that order has not been challenged by the defendant in this proceeding, only the admissibility.
Well, actually, the Court of Appeals opinion said that the General District Court committed error in concluding that a collateral attack of this kind could be used.
Correct, Your Honor.
So it's not like we don't know what the right answer is.
Correct, Your Honor.
Let me ask you a question, too, counsel. When they appealed that from district court to circuit court, after it had already been reduced to DWI first, could the Commonwealth have challenged the decision by the district court to say that it was reduced from second to first because of the problem with the enhancement?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, the defendant actually pled guilty once they got up to second court, so there was no opportunity for the Commonwealth to revisit that issue.
If there had been a trial, could you have done that? In other words, is there any mechanism for the Commonwealth to appeal that decision by the district court?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. It would entirely depend on exactly how that ruling was framed, which the Commonwealth's position that we don't know how that ruling was framed, if it was an evidentiary issue, what exactly it was. So it's
but doesn't the Commonwealth have a very limited right of appeal
at all?
And so when the defendant took the case from district court to circuit court, mm-hmm. apparently satisfied with that it was reduced to DWI first, and you concede you can't do anything about that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there any mechanism to challenge that ruling?
No, I do not believe so, Your Honor.
Okay.
Well, why would you appeal a evidentiary ruling of a district court when the case is before the circuit court de novo? Why is the appeal issue relevant?
It's the Commonwealth's position that it's not relevant because, as this court has recognized in its jurisprudence, an appeal from the district court to the circuit court is a de novo appeal that, for all purposes, is a nullity, except in the limited exception that's been noted by Davis and Turner, and that says for double jeopardy purposes, the Commonwealth cannot re-indict or re-up a charge that the defendant has been acquitted of. In this case, we don't have that here. We just have the evidentiary ruling.
But even if we were to expand the acquittal doctrine to include an evidentiary ruling, the bottom line here is the 2012 decision by the General District Court holding 2010 order invalid was a question of law. It was an erroneous constitutional ruling. It wasn't a question of fact at all. Does collateral estoppel even apply to a question of law?
I'm not sure of the answer of that, Your Honor. The Commonwealth's position is that as the Court of Appeals and this court is suggesting that the district court in 2012 could not take the action that the defendant is arguing happened. Therefore,
well, if a court makes a decision of law, answers a question of law as opposed to a question of fact, does collateral estoppel doctrinally even apply? Even if every other instance of the elements of collateral estoppel were applicable?
No, Your Honor, I cannot believe so.
So it's crucial then, isn't it, whether the 2012 ruling as to the constitutionality of that earlier 2010 conviction was a legal conclusion of the court, and most of the time when we say the Constitution is violated, we characterize it as a legal conclusion.
Yes, Your Honor, I do think it's important. Unfortunately, I don't think on this record we can determine exactly what the district court did in 2012 because it was the district court and we have no transcript or recording of that. I understand that the Court of Appeals relied heavily on the purported stipulation by the Commonwealth, but as the Commonwealth's position that that stipulation was incredibly unclear and does not concede any issue away. And in fact, the Court of Appeals erroneously concluded that the trial court...
But you've got to distinguish between a question of fact, which is what happened at that hearing, and a question of law. Okay, here's what happened. Now, how do we characterize what happened? The appellee's argument is that the 2010 order was found to be unconstitutional. It's in his brief at page 24. Mm-hmm. His constitutional rights were violated. And that was the reason, that was part of the proffer for the 2012 decision. Well, is that a question of fact or a question of law, whether or not that 2010 conviction was unconstitutional or not?
I believe, Your Honor, if it, that would be a question of law. However, whether or not it is admitted would be a question of fact. I'm not sure if I'm properly answering your question, but again, I would just reiterate that unfortunately we are not sure how that ruling was determined by that court.
Counsel, before you get into the proffer, and I know you want to talk about that, I wanted to ask you one more question about this collateral estoppel issue. And isn't there a line of cases that basically says you should be cautious in applying collateral estoppel in the situation where the Commonwealth doesn't have a right to appeal?
Yes.
That was really the reason for my question. It was really intended to be a friendly question, that you really had nothing you could do at the circuit court level to challenge that district court ruling.
Yes, Your Honor. That is true. Then that normally in collateral estoppel, you do see a mutuality that has not been applied the same in criminal context as it is in civil context, which is why it was not argued heavily in my brief. But there is a line of cases that suggest that collateral estoppel is not applied the same in criminal cases. And based on this court's jurisprudence, I had not found a case where collateral estoppel had been applied to the Commonwealth for a set of facts that is a new course of conduct on a new day and a new time, because the reason collateral estoppel applies in criminal context is for double jeopardy protections, which are just simply not in danger in this case.
Thank you.
So the Commonwealth position is that the trial court in this case properly ruled that in 2010 the general district court found the defendant guilty of a DUI first offense. That's the first conviction. And then in 2012 he was charged with a second offense and ultimately found guilty, or he was charged with a second offense of DUI and ultimately found guilty of a first in general district court. And he appealed that up and he pled guilty to a first in circuit court. The trial court found that collateral estoppel did not apply because the defendant failed to meet two elements of collateral estoppel, both that the factual issue had actually been litigated and that there was a final valid judgment. The Court of Appeals finding was correct, and the trial court's finding was correct, and the Court of Appeals erred when it substituted its own fact finding with regard to the trial court in the Commonwealth stipulation. The burden was on the defendant to show that the factual issue was actually litigated. Leonard failed to do this. While the Commonwealth conceded that the 2010 conviction order admissibility was addressed in the district court prior to its findings, the defendant guilty of a first offense, the stipulation did not satisfy Leonard's burden. The stipulation provides no indication why the district court found the order inadmissible, how the ruling may or may not have been framed, and nor could it, since the prosecutor said he was not there. The Court of Appeals engaged in its own fact-finding when it heavily relied on the stipulation and even assumed that the trial court accepted it, when there's nothing in the record that says that the trial court did accept the stipulation. Furthermore, the only...
Is there anything in the record that supports the bracketed language about that stipulation that's in the opinion?
I believe the Court of Appeals got that bracketed language from several pages forward, and it relies heavily on saying when you take the entire transcript into the context, that must have been what the Commonwealth was stipulating.
But in fact, at page 101, where this quote comes from, none of that language
none
is
of
there.
That language is there. In fact, where the Court of Appeals inserts this language, the prosecutor stops talking and says, I wasn't there, completely disavowing essentially the language that the Court of Appeals inserts into it. And then there's nothing to indicate that the trial court then accepts that stipulation, and the trial court was able to reject that stipulation and find its own conclusion and determination of fact that the defendant had failed to meet its burden.
But when you keep talking about a fact, the fact is, was the 2010 order admitted or not admitted?
Yes.
Well, so what? It obviously wasn't admitted by the 2012. The question is not that. The question is, why was it admitted? What was the issue that the judge decided in 2012 that caused the judge to not admit the 2010 order? And that's answered by the appellee herself, which is, it was a constitutional ruling. So that's a question of law. It's not a question of fact. It seems that these two things are confused in this case.
I think that is entirely possible, and if this court were to find that it was a question of law, that therefore would not be subject to collateral estoppel, I don't think that the Commonwealth would challenge that, but I unfortunately cannot say that I can speak more clearly to that issue, Your Honor. And furthermore, the only valid reason the 2010 conviction order would have been collaterally attacked would be if Leonard did not have counsel at that proceeding, and there's no evidence from the record that that is true. And because collateral convictions cannot be collaterally attacked in a subsequent proceeding, the district court could not have ruled that order invalid, and that conviction order stands today as a valid conviction that Leonard has. Furthermore, neither the Court of Appeals nor the defendant explained how a de novo appeal from the district court to the circuit court should survive for all evidentiary bases. The Court of Appeals' reliance on its previous case, Turner, and this court's case, Davis, is misplaced. Turner is well consistent with established double jeopardy principles that the Commonwealth cannot place twice in jeopardy a defendant for the same crime once he has been acquitted. However, as I've said already, this case does not have those dangers of double jeopardy. Double jeopardy prevents a second prosecution after acquittal, a second prosecution after conviction, and multiple punishments for the same offense. That's simply not what this case has here.
Counsel, can I interrupt for a second?
Yeah.
What do you think that Highsmith stands for? The Court of Appeals used basically the one case, Highsmith, to make this basically conclusion. How do you interpret Highsmith?
I interpret Highsmith similar. I think it goes along with all the cases that Turner, Davis, Simon, that say if there is a fact that has been put at issue from a certain set of a course of conduct and the Commonwealth loses on that issue and results in acquittal or a dismissal, then the Commonwealth cannot use that evidence in the same course of conduct. In Simon, it was blood evidence. In Davis, I believe it was whether or not he was actually the driver of a car. They all arrive out of the same course of conduct, whereas this is a wholly new course of conduct, which takes it outside of the double jeopardy concerns.
You wanted to save 3 minutes. You're down to two.
Thank you, Your Honor. To briefly wrap up, presently the defendant has two prior valid conviction orders from 2010 and 2012 that were properly admitted into evidence by the trial court. Circuit court found that he had failed to satisfy his burden for collateral estoppel, and the Commonwealth would request that that is affirmed, and I will reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Michael Messman, and I represent the appellee Gregory Leonard. The case at bar in front of you today is a constitutional case, but it's also a very point of strict constructionist with regard to what actually happened. What we do know, and I want to be perfectly clear on this, is the Commonwealth attorney stipulated. And that's what occurred. On page 119 of the original transcript, and I'm going to get that and read that for you, the Commonwealth attorney actually stipulated, and let's have it right here. I'll stipulate. It's my understanding that that was the reason for why Judge Hutchins reduced the charges to a DUI first. I don't think there's any evidence before the court. I will make it evidence now.
Okay, what was the reason that he was stipulating to? What was
Honor, I would go a little bit further on this, too, because it also specifically says, yes, I wasn't there, he said, but I was given the details.
Okay, what was the, okay, so let's assume it's a stipulation.
Yes, sir.
He stipulated that a court in an earlier case made a ruling. What was the ruling?
Well, Your Honor, and that's where I would take you to the memorandum of law that was submitted by Attorney John Hooker that the Commonwealth attorney had the ability to respond to. That is also part of this court's record as well. And that memorandum of law specifically spoke to the validity of the 2010 argument. And that's what I would stipulate, or that's what I would suggest.
So the question was the 2010 conviction valid constitutionally? Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why is that a question of fact? It sounds to me that it's a question of law, and collateral estoppel 101 does not apply to questions of law, only to questions of fact.
Well, Your Honor, and that's where I would agree with part of what you're saying, and I would also offer some additional information to you. According to Boykins v. Alabama, and that is what Mr. Hooker argued down below in the trial court, was that the argument was that 2010 conviction could not be upheld constitutionally because the box was not checked. That conviction and the warrant and the back page where these boxes are always checked is in the record as well, which does indicate, if you look at it, that box that says you have the right to not self-incriminate, you have the right to confront your accusers, it was not checked.
Counsel, let me interrupt you 1 second. Does that box have to be checked if you have counsel?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. I mean, just because as an attorney I'm standing there beside you doesn't mean I can personally waive your rights. No, sir. Absolutely not. I believe that a judge's and the courts and the case law does support that the onus is upon, in Boykins v. Alabama in particular, that the onus is on the judge to ask the question, to affirm that occurs. And just because you have an attorney does not mean I don't plead guilty or not guilty for you.
Why didn't the defense counsel make that argument to the circuit court?
Well, because, Your Honor, he didn't have to. And I'll tell you why. The DUI second and under Turner v. Commonwealth, which is perfectly on point, specifically states that once you cannot be a trial de novo or otherwise for the same offense after an acquittal by the court having authority and jurisdiction to try. So the DUI second was no longer a DUI second. He didn't have to make that argument at the court at the circuit court because it was a DUI first.
No, I'm talking about in this particular case. When the court says, I don't believe res judicata is applicable, why not make the constitutional argument concerning the use of the first conviction in this case? I mean, you could pull this thing back out, show the judge the box, and make that very same argument, and you win or lose as a question of law in front of this circuit court.
Because the Commonwealth stipulated, and that's what happened, Your Honor. And I want to be...
I thought the reason would be because if you made the argument, you'd lose the argument. Because a collateral attack for anything other than the absence of counsel is not permissible in a recidivism aggregated crime context. It is permissible in a habeas context, but not otherwise.
Well, Your Honor, and I would go one step further and say that it's permissible when it becomes double jeopardy. And that's what we have before us here as well. So let's not lose sight of that argument, too, is this is an issue of double jeopardy. Once Mr. Leonard was at the trial court in the general district court, and that judge heard the evidence and said, I now rule this as a DUI first, he was acquitted under Turner v. Commonwealth of the DUI second. Therefore, it is no longer a trial de novo on a DUI second. It is a trial de novo on the DUI first.
Can I ask, how does that help you at all? I mean, what if somebody just had two DUI firsts that were completely legitimate and they were being charged with a DUI third? They still would be convicted.
You're right, except for the stipulation. That's what we have. That's what separates this case. This is not a slippery slope case, Your Honors. This is not a overreaching. This is not going to be the next precedent that we can use for every single DUI third case. Absolutely not.
So you're saying that stipulation meant that the DUI first from 2010 is now gone?
It's not gone, but it cannot be. What the answer is yes, I would say. Based upon a little careful reflection there, yes, it is gone because it became valid, constitutionally valid by the Commonwealth attorney stipulation. That's what makes this case so special.
The Commonwealth attorney stipulated that the ruling was made. The
right.
Commonwealth attorney did not stipulate the ruling was right. And the Court of Appeals opinion, in which you won, has this paragraph in it. At the outset, the Court of Appeals held, it is important to note that to the extent the appellant's assertions about the May 7, 2012 General District Court ruling are correct, the General District Court committed error.
And, Your Honor, I'm not in disagreement with the fact that that's what the Court of Appeals has opined. What I'm stipulating to, and what I'm suggesting to this court, and let's get into the case law on Ledbetter versus Commonwealth and what Kelly versus Commonwealth is quoted. In Kelly, we were concerned with the concession made by the Commonwealth at trial, which the Attorney General attempted to repudiate. Well, Your Honor, that's what's happening here, and that's why this case is only so very narrow. The Commonwealth attorney stipulated, and you know what? He may not like it now. And as a matter of fact,
but the stipulation was to the basis of the general district court action, not to the validity, ultimately, of the conviction.
Well, Your Honor, I would disagree. And the reason I would disagree is because once that stipulation takes place, and he specifically says, I will make it evidence now, the Commonwealth is bound by the stipulations of their attorneys. The Court of Appeals is bound by the stipulations of attorneys, and the Supreme Court is as well.
On questions of fact, but not law, right?
Well, Your Honor, I would say to some degree that if a Commonwealth or a defense attorney stipulates to a particular set of facts, and that's what occurred here, and a particular set of law with regard to what occurred, because then if we take that argument one step further, now we're supposing what happened. We don't know, but we know that Commonwealth does because he also states one step below, I was given the details.
The problem with your argument is just what Justice McCullough said. The Commonwealth and the defendant cannot bind the court on stipulations of law. So they could stipulate all day long that the 2010 conviction had no validity. That doesn't bind the court, and the Court of Appeals said as much. The court was wrong when it found that.
Well, Your Honor, and my argument would be that the Court of Appeals, and unless you're, and this is where this all becomes, what are we going to do from here? Unless we go back and say, okay, well, did Judge Hudson look at this and say that, yes, this was constitutionally invalid? And Your Honors, under Boykins v. Alabama, it was constitutionally invalid. It is a question of law, and the law states that his constitutional rights were in jeopardy.
What constitutional rights were violated in 2010?
The right to self-incriminate. The right against
trust. So he wasn't given warnings of all the colloquy issues that you normally get at a guilty plea, is that right?
Yes.
But he did have counsel, is that right?
That's my understanding.
All right, what authority do you have that you can collaterally attack in a recidivism aggregating crime case a prior conviction for a constitutional defect other than the absence of counsel?
Well, Your Honor, and under the absence of counsel argument, I would specifically state it's our constitutional rights are never going to be thwarted because you have an attorney standing beside you. And under double jeopardy principles, Boykins v. Alabama, it is very clear you must uphold the constitutional rights of every single citizen. You must. And if we come now as the Supreme Court and say, well, we're going to invalidate that because we don't really know what happened below, well, we do, because the warrant itself, which is, again, in this court's record, specifically does not have that box checked. And, Your Honor, I would submit to you, based upon a strict constructionist, that, yes, at all costs, at any point in time, we must protect the constitutional
if
rights.
If we find that the warrant is not constitutionally invalid, where does that leave you?
Well, Your Honor, that still leaves me with the stipulation. And the stipulation to the effect that it becomes, and I understand this court's having some angst about the fact that can a Commonwealth stipulate to the law? And the answer is, every single day, attorneys get stuck with stipulations or statements that they made. And let me give you an example. At the Court of Appeals, as was noted in the opinion from the Court of Appeals, the Commonwealth attorney conceded that it should be reduced down to a DUI second based upon the factual presentation presented. That we have now, Kelly versus Commonwealth, that is right on point, that specifically states that when you stipulate, when the Commonwealth has stipulated to a series of events, you cannot then come back and correct it. In Kelly versus Commonwealth, it actually was a constitutional issue based upon a case that had been pending. And I believe the case was Jackson that was pending at the time. And the Commonwealth stipulated that, yes, the gentleman's rights, Kelly's rights, had been violated because that case was already pending and that they went ahead and went forward, even though it was pending before the courts. And the Attorney General tried to repudiate that and come back on an appeal and say, no, well, Kelly versus Commonwealth held the Attorney General and the Commonwealth accountable to that stipulation. And that's what we must do here as well. And under the collateral estoppel, under double jeopardy, it's imperative that we go and we keep accountability for what we're doing. And that's why Kelly is so important. And Kelly, in reference to that, is with regard to that it's a double jeopardy standard, but it's also the fact that it is very specific to what occurred with the Commonwealth and stipulating to information of law. And that's what I would submit to this court, is that we have this situation that is so narrow. And that's why, again, this case is only applicable to this exact set of circumstances. This case is very narrow to what actually occurred.
So we are bound, the seven of us are bound by General District Court's ruling in 2012 that was erroneous as to the constitutionality of a 2010 conviction when we're hearing a case that involved neither of those direct appeals? We're bound by that?
Well, Your Honor, I would stipulate, or that favorite word, I would submit to the court that it's not, and I'm not necessarily conceding the fact that it was erroneous. I'm not necessarily conceding that.
Assume for the sake of argument it was, as the Court of Appeals correctly held.
Well, if the Court of Appeals is correct in its opinion, and again, I'm not stipulating to that, then I would submit to this court that it comes down to what does this court do based upon that? Well, it has to reflect on Kelly. It really does. And we have to reflect back on Turner. And we have to reflect on the double jeopardy standard that is the most important to all of us as it comes down to constitutionality. And the Court of Appeals asked a somewhat funny question, but it was to the point of, well, should the Commonwealth have to live with it? The answer is yes. The answer is yes. And because there have been so many times when defense attorneys have stood before you and they've had bad rulings, rulings that weren't fair, rulings that didn't come or thought that they went the way they should have gone, but they're left with the consequence of those rulings. And that happens every day.
What's unfair about convicting him of DUI third when it's his third DUI?
Because, Your Honor, I would submit to you it's not his third DUI based upon the invalidity. And that's what makes it so important to this particular set of cases, or this particular case, is the fact that when he stands before you, that you have to be very concerned with, we have to be very concerned with what actually occurred. None of us were there. I wasn't there, for sure. But when the Commonwealth said, I will make it evidence, that's where we go. Because until that, we don't have anything. But that's what he did. Those were his words. That was not his prompting.
Counsel, let me ask you this question. Wouldn't it make more sense, I understand your argument, but wouldn't it make more sense since the district court in 2012 had no authority to invalidate that 2010 conviction, to uphold the action of the district court in getting the 2012 charge as a DWI first, but still leaving the 2010 conviction valid. Wouldn't that make more sense?
Well, Your Honor, clearly, and not to be disrespectful, but the general district court believes that she did have the authority to invalidate that. Absolutely. So based upon
but
the...
But she didn't do that. It's still on the record. She didn't say, okay, I want this expunged from the record. I want this conviction removed from your driving record. You no longer have this 2010 conviction. All she said was, you can't use it for enhancement. That's all she said, isn't it?
I would agree with the fact that she said you cannot use it for enhancement. Expungement is a whole different process, but what occurred from there is it became the DUI first. That's the issue that's in front of the court as well, is the fact that this is not a DUI second for enhancement purposes. And that
it doesn't need to be a DUI second if the 2010 DUI is valid.
I would not disagree with that, but I would stipulate again, and that's part of the frustration that I think we're all experiencing just a tad bit, is that we don't know exactly if Judge Hutchins said, okay, I'm invalidating this because, but what I will stipulate to you is that box wasn't checked, we do know that. That memorandum of law that was submitted to the trial court, which talks, I see my time is
coming. Go ahead, finish up.
Thank you. That memorandum of law that was submitted to the court that specifically spoke about Boykins v. Alabama and the stipulation by the Commonwealth and the concession by the Attorney General, this is where we are and this is the case at hand. And I would submit to you that the Court of Appeals made the proper ruling with regard to this particular set of facts. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
First, the Court of Appeals ruling that the district court's actions in 2010 were improper was not appealed to this court. And second, the Commonwealth is not repudiating the stipulation. The stipulation merely was not sufficient to carry the defendant's burden to establish collateral estoppel. It is within the trial court's discretion to admit a valid conviction order into evidence. Thus, the evidence was sufficient to convict the defendant of his third DUI. The Court of Appeals erred when it concluded the valid conviction order was inadmissible for purposes of sentencing enhancement, erred when it found the trial court abused its discretion in admitting the document, and erred in not finding the evidence sufficient. Therefore, the Commonwealth would ask this court to reverse the Court of Appeals and to affirm the convictions from the trial court.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.